Welcome to episode number 45 of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price. I am joined by Chad Bird, and we have Brandon Hansen back.
Brandon is back.
The move to New York is complete. he's like a pastor now. He better have like wiser things to say.
Yeah.
he's been storing up wisdom for the last few weeks while he's been gone, so he's probably going to dominate this program.
I know. Yes.
I'm like the Silent Bob of pastors sometimes. Just like sit there and with a smile on my face. Uh-huh. A knowing nod. I'm hearing you.
Yeah. But then dropping that gold nugget every once in a while, right?
That's every once in a while, yeah.
All right, I'm waiting for it. No pressure. I'll be waiting all show. Where is it? Where is it? Well, where are we at in this story that Brandon's going to be dropping this gold nugget in?
So we're in Genesis chapter 34. We wrapped up the story of Jacob's reconciliation with Esau last time. That story was a little bit unique when you look at the Old Testament as a whole, because it was overall a positive story. You have two brothers who've been on the outs for two decades, and they actually get back together. They hug each other. They weep on each other. They're happy, they're reconciled, there's forgiveness. I mean, as far as the Old Testament goes, you can't get much better than that. And we're gonna fall right back into the regular kind of stories today with chapter 34, because let's see, we have rape, we have murder, we have deceit, we have pillage, we have looting, and we have strife within families, all squeezed into one chapter.
Yeah, some of that real Old Testament low anthropology.
Real Old Testament low anthropology. Yeah, humanity at its worst.
Right on.
Well, so that's where we are. So we actually skip quite a few years between the end of chapter 33 and the beginning of chapter 34. We're not told how many years, but when Jacob comes back from his exile, he has most of his children. Most of his children are born, all except for Benjamin, who's the youngest son. But they're all young. The oldest one, Reuben, he's probably in his early teens at the most. Some time has passed, because in this chapter, his daughter, at least the only daughter we're told about so far, Dinah, she's old enough to go out on her own. And she's the one who is seized by the ruler of a city and is raped. And then her brothers are older as well, because they are able to take up swords and to exact vengeance for the crime committed against her. So several years have passed before we actually get to the beginning of this chapter. So what happened was Jacob and his family, they settled close to this place called Shechem. And we're told at the beginning of the chapter that Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. Now, it is significant, I think, as we go through this chapter, to keep in mind whose daughter Dinah is. I don't think it's simply a coincidence that is mentioned at the beginning of the chapter. Dinah's not the daughter of Rachel. She's the daughter of Leah. And the reason that's significant is for two reasons. One is, it will be her full brothers, Levi and Simeon, who avenge her. It's not a half brother. It's two full brothers who avenge her. And it also is significant because, as we'll see as the story unfolds, Jacob is amazingly passive and silent throughout this whole story. Now, one wonders how this all would have went down if the chapter had begun by saying, now Dinah, the daughter of Rachel, whom she had born to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. So you can't, at least I can't help but wonder if part of the reason for the way Jacob acts is because this is the daughter of his unloved wife. And because of that, he ends up being relatively passive and lets his sons do what needs to be done. So that's the way it starts out. We'll just kind of go over the story and then come back and talk about some particulars. The basic thrust of the story happens right away in these opening verses, because when Dinah goes out to visit the daughters of the land, one of the royalty there, a guy named Shechem, who was a prince, no doubt a spoiled prince, one who was used to getting his way. He sees her. Got three Hebrew verbs here. He sees her. He takes her. And he sees her. He takes her. Actually, four verbs. Sees her, takes her, has sex with her, and humiliates her. Now, most of your English translations say that he lay with her by force. Actually, get two Hebrew words there. He slept with her, and he humiliated her. So he raped her. And then you have this strange description of his reaction afterward. It says he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl, and he spoke tenderly to her. Now, if you were just to read that verse completely out of context, you didn't know what it was about, you might think this was all positive, because many of the verbs there are used in positive ways. But you really have here a kind of a sociopath. First of all, he rapes the girl, and then he claims that he loves her, and then he speaks tenderly to her, and that his soul is clinging to her. It's really a deeply disturbing, despicable scene that you have transpiring here. Now, as the story goes on, Shechem talks to his father. He says, get me this young girl for a wife. So what happens after that is that Shechem and his dad, who is the ruler of this city or this city state, they go to Jacob and to his sons to try and work out some kind of marriage deal with them. So Jacob hears what happens. His sons are out in the field with the livestock, and Jacob kept silent, it says, until they came in. In fact, if you look through this chapter, Jacob doesn't say a word until the very close of it. Chapter 30, which is the next to last verse, is the only time that Jacob speaks. So Hamor, who's the ruler of the city-state, and his son, who is the rapist, they go out to talk to Jacob and to his sons. And when the brothers of Dinah hear what's happened, they are filled with rage. But instead of acting on their rage, I guess you could say that the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, because they practice a bit of deceit themselves. Hamor comes to them and he says that his son wants to marry Jacob's daughter. There's no mention of the rape, no mention of the seizing, no mention of the humiliation. He just says, my son wants to marry your daughter. And he says, you can intermarry with us. So give your daughters to us and we'll give our daughters to you. And we can live together and the land's going to be open before you. You can trade, you can acquire property. So they make it seem as if this is nothing more than sort of a business deal. It'll benefit me, it'll benefit you. We can all be happy with the outcome of this. And Shechem, the son, the prince, adds to it. He says, I tell you what, ask me whatever bridal payment you want, and I'll give it to you. No questions asked. Whatever you want, I want this girl for my wife. Then it's not Jacob, but it's Jacob's sons who speak. It says that they answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit. And here's what they said. They said, we can't do this, give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, because that would be a disgrace to us. So they say, we have one condition. All we ask, there's no bridal payment, there's nothing else. All we ask is that you become like us, and that every male among you be circumcised. And if you'll do that, then we'll give our daughters to you, and you can give our daughters to us, and we'll all live happily as one people.
This is the weirdest, sneakiest plan ever.
It is extremely sneaky. And and very ironically fitting, don't you think?
It is.
Yeah, because the rape happened, and now the brothers say, I tell you what, why don't you wound the end of your penis, the very one, this is of course implied, the very one that you used to rape our sister, and then we'll see what happens. It's very sinister. So that's what they end up doing, amazingly.
I understand, like, here's the thing that's weird about this. Okay, if there's like a girl, I mean, if you're crazy, which this guy seems like he's crazy.
Yeah, he's nuts.
Yeah, so whatever. So like he's all about this girl. Or maybe even if you weren't crazy, maybe, I don't know, whatever. You're all about this girl and, I don't know. So just assume like maybe if you're not a sociopath or something, but, and like that's the deal. And he's like, all right, well, the people have went to war over girls and stuff. I mean, I guess I can understand that, like, maybe you'd be like, all right, if that's what I got to do. How about like all the other dudes though? Hey guys, we're all doing this. I mean, if I was there, I'd be like, hold up, wait. This guy didn't even have that many daughters, bro. Like, I'm not doing this.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the answer to that is in the conversation that Hamor and Shechem have with the men of the city. I just noticed this morning when I was looking through this. When Hamor and Shechem go to the civic center, if you will, to the gate of the city where all the city business is decided, they basically relay the conversation that they had with Jacob and with his brothers, but they add this very significant detail. This is in verse 23. So they're saying, you know, all we gotta do is be circumcised, we can intermarry, blah blah blah. But then they say in verse 23, will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them and they will live with us. I think that is what they're really pushing to clinch the deal here with the men of the city. I mean, it still seems really crazy to me that they would agree to this.
Yeah, they'd be like, hey man, you should do this. There might be some sheep in it for you. I'd be like, yeah. No.
You're going to get rich. Yeah. Well, we do know that Jacob was he had lots of flocks and herds.
Yeah, he did.
So they were arguing on the basis of these guys' pocketbooks.
And you have to assume that there's a certain element of like these guys are in charge, and they're just, maybe they're not even as much like, they might be telling you nicely that this is what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, like, I don't know what the power system is here, but it seems like these two guys probably are running stuff, right? And so
yeah. They're not a king with totalitarian powers, but they certainly are royalty.
Right, and not someone you want to be on the bad side of.
Right, yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, when a superior puts forward something as a suggestion, but you really know it's a command.
Right. Yeah.
The boss says, what do you think about us doing this or that? And you're like, yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, you know it's supposed to happen.
Yeah,
because they're the ones with the authority and the influence. Well, that's what happens. All the men of the city, they agree. Every male is circumcised either that day or at least the next day. So far, according to the perspective of the people of Shechem, everything is going according to plan. And it's at this point that Jacob's two sons, Simeon and Levi, who were the full brothers of Dinah, they are able now to fulfill really their goal all along. It's the third day. This came about on the third day when they were in pain, that is, of course, the men who were circumcised, that Simeon and Levi took up a sword and they came on the city unawares and they killed every man. Now, it's at this point in the story that something unexpected happens. This is one of the beauties, the literary beauties of the scriptures that we sometimes miss. because the Bible is, of course, full of stories, and there is the gift of storytelling. And the Bible is, of course, very good at this storytelling. And one aspect of storytelling is to withhold information and then to surprise us with it later on. And that's what we have at this point of the story, because it says that they killed all the males and they killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword. And then all of a sudden, we are told this detail. And they took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. Now, up to this point, we had no idea that not only was Dinah raped, but she had been more or less kidnapped. She had been held in Shechem's house up until this point. Now, when you're reading through this, you assume, okay, Dinah was raped. She went back home. She told everyone what had happened. She's there, you know, safe at home. Well, she's not. The whole time these marriage negotiations were going on, the whole time this news of her rape had come back to Jacob and to his family, Dinah was in Shechem, was in the king's house, was in the prince's house, unable to leave, and her brothers go in not only to exact vengeance for her rape, but to rescue her from Shechem's house. It's a bit of a detail that is extremely significant and not disclosed until this point in the story. Now, as if things have not been bad enough, the rape, the deceit, the slaughter. Now we have the looting beginning, because Simeon and Levi, they went and they killed all the guys. But now the brothers, Jacob's other sons, they came upon the slain and they looted the city because they had defiled their sister. And they take the flocks and the herds and their donkeys and everything that was in the city. And they even capture and they take the little ones and the wives of the men who had been slaughtered. So this is a complete taking of the city, and everything that belonged to the city is now the possession of Jacob's sons. Now all of this happens. Kind of wrap up the story. We'll go back and talk about some things. All of this happens. And as I said earlier, Jacob has not uttered a word. It's at this point in verse 30 that he finally speaks, and his speech, I counted them up. There are 8 first person pronouns in this one verse. Me, me, I, me, me, over and over. So he says to Jacob and to Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men, being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household. So Jacob is living up to his reputation. He's concerned about himself, and he's concerned about himself, and he's concerned about himself some more. His sons do get the last word. They say, should he treat our sister as a harlot? There's a bit of ambiguity here, because who is the he? Are they talking about Shechem, or are they talking about their own father? We're not told. We're just given the question, should he treat our sister as a harlot? So this is the gospel of the Lord.
Yeah.
That's great.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks be to thee, O Christ.
There's a weird thing. Now, okay, so you have like a dual thing going on here, where like part of you is like, this is a pretty sweet plan, and those guys probably, you know, they deserve what they get. At the same time, it sort of breaks that Old Testament eye for an eye thing, where like God's probably not like in favor of you like killing everybody.
Probably not.
You know?
Yeah.
That's not really eye for an eye, you know. You kidnapped my sister, everyone's dying. It's like, well,
everybody's dead. Yeah. Kill them all, let God sort them out.
Yeah. So that's some pretty
some pretty brutal stuff.
That's some pretty thorough, yeah, some Old thorough Testament vengeance.
Boondock Saints stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah. This will come back. This isn't the last that we hear of this this episode, because this will come back to bite Simeon and Levi much later on, because when you get to the close of Genesis, which is not quite the last chapter, but chapter 49. Chapter 49 is the blessing that Jacob pronounces upon each of his sons before his death. And so Reuben is the firstborn, and Reuben gets canceled out of the blessing of the firstborn because he commits incest. He sleeps with one of the maidservants of Jacob. So one of Jacob's co-wives, Reuben, his son, sleeps with her. So he's canceled out. Firstborn is. The second two in line are Simeon and Levi. And this is what Jacob says to them. He says, "Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." So Jacob didn't forget this incident. And when it came time on his deathbed, decades later, he did not bestow upon them the blessing of the firstborn that he had withheld from Reuben, his biological firstborn. Instead, because of what they did here, I'm assuming that those verses are alluding to what they did to Shechem. The blessing of the firstborn is withheld from the second and the third born son as well, which, when you look at this story in the broader light of the biblical narrative, is extremely interesting, because of what Levi and Simeon did here. The blessing is passed over them, and the fourth in line to receive the blessing is Judah. So on account of this terrible story, which is just filled with sin, and everywhere you look in this chapter, but because of this, the blessing that is passed over, that passes over Simeon, that passes over Levi, lands on Judah. And that blessing is that he will be the one who will carry forth the promise of the seed, the messianic seed, so that the Messiah will be born from his tribe, and not the tribe of Reuben, and not the tribe of Simeon, and not the tribe of Levi. So in the broader biblical narrative, this story is all about the messianic line, the line from which the Messiah himself shall come.
It is a little bit weird to think about Jacob being like, well, when it comes to blessings, I like to keep these things legit. Is it, you know?
Of all people to be concerned about making sure the right person receives the blessing.
Yes. Like, I like to keep this on the up and up. I'm not going to bless somebody who's engaged in any shady behavior. That's not how these blessings work.
Yeah.
You got to be, you need to be, have some semblance of purity if I'm going to bless you. Jeez, man. Like, come on. And,
I tell you, Jacob is a character. There is no, there's no doubt about that. You know, I have a sister and I have a daughter. And even though I've not experienced what these brothers experience with the rape of their sister, it's part of me feels a great sympathy with their actions.
Sure.
Because who would not be angry, indignant, and wanting to punish the perpetrators of a crime like this? And there's nothing wrong with feelings of anger over injustice and violence like this. I think where the brothers went wrong is what you alluded to earlier, is that they took matters into their own hands, and they perpetrated violence against the whole city. It wasn't just the punishment that was inflicted upon Shechem, but every single male in the city was slain.
Yeah, and I mean, it alludes to the fact that these guys got like a lot. It sounds like these guys got wives and stuff. Some of them.
Yeah, these were married, so now they made widows.
Yeah, that's never good.
And orphans, yeah, you know, the
that's not good.
No, it's not. So it's a sad story, really from beginning to end. Now, what do you think about the deception of the brothers using circumcision as a means to gain the upper hand over these men?
It's like me like poisoning communion and being like, all right, here's the thing. I'd love for everyone to be able to be welcome. So I'm going to need you guys to all commune first. All right, no problem.
Right. Yeah, let me baptize you first. Then you can be part of our family, yeah, and then end up holding them under the water
These baptisms last 10 minutes.
Yeah. So it's really using a gift of God, which is what circumcision is, or using the word of God, which is what commands circumcision, as a affront for something else. It's, I guess you could say that it's using a gift of God or using the word of God in order to punish someone else. And in that way, it's doubly deceitful, because not only do they lie, but they use this blessed gift of God, circumcision, in order to, as a means by which to seek vengeance against someone who has wronged them. So all sorts of bad stuff going on here.
Yeah, you had to wonder if those guys ever came across any other dudes that they were like, that they legitimately were like, no, seriously, you should be circumcised. They're like, yeah, no, I heard about that. No. You know, you're trying to convert some people, you know, get some proselytes, and you're like, well, here's the deal. You know, you come worship our God, do a little circumcision, it's not a big deal. It's like, oh, no. I already heard about your guys'. Yeah, I've heard about the circumcision move.
Yeah, yeah. We know what happens on the heels of your circumcising. So we're waiting here for Brandon to jump in here with his nuggets of wisdom that he has been reserving for these last 6 weeks or so.
I know how to stay silent before my betters. I've got a weird parallel thought. I don't know how much of a parallel it is, but it just reminds me of Galatians 5. You've got these guys. One guy who comes in and does something awful, something that all of the little nation of Israel right now says should not be done in Israel. And they come to them and they go, yeah, but what do we got to do to make this right? I don't know if they even understand that it's wrong. It seems like it's, they don't have any, they're like, yeah, we can get married now. What do we got to do? And when you look at verses like 2 through 4 here, I'll just read it. Look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision that he is obligated to keep the whole law. You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law, you have fallen from grace. And it's interesting to look at this entire city goes and gets circumcised. Almost, you know, not even intentionally, but almost in a way that this is going to cover up and make things right, and we're going to be able to live together. But there's still the sin there. Yeah, circumcision isn't an atonement for sin. Keeping the law in one part doesn't make up for breaking it in the whole. And so, if you're going to be justified by even just something as a one part of the law, then you have to keep the whole law. You're under a curse. You're severed from that any righteousness.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great parallel. And certainly the people of Shechem, they're misusing circumcision for their own benefit. as often happens with the law, such as the people in Galatians were doing. They're attempting to cover their sin with that which is no covering, is an incapable of providing the kind of forgiveness and atonement that is truly needed. So the people of Shechem are accepting circumcision, but just, I guess you could say, like some people accept at least outwardly a semblance of religion only to better themselves. That's really what's happening here with the people of Shechem. They agree to circumcision. They agree to this really sacred religious act, but only in order to profit themselves. It's not really to receive any kind of covenant community. It's not really to receive the blessings of God, but it's only in order to get more cows and donkeys and oxen and sheep to make themselves to rich. And hey, they might get some more wives to boot. So it becomes nothing more than self-serving kind of use of the Old Testament sacrament.
Yeah, it's like that couple that comes in and like needs to baptize their baby, they haven't been to church in like ever, and they're like, got to get this baby baptized because like grandma's gonna straight cut us out of the will if we don't.
Yeah, right.
Like that's
right.
A real thing. Like that happens. You know?
That happens. Yeah, yeah. You know? I mean, we're in danger of losing our inheritance if we don't baptize little Johnny here. Yeah, so yeah, let's just go ahead and do it.
Yeah, like grandma won't have it because grandma's like old school. And if we don't get this baby baptized, we will be in big trouble.
Yeah. And what do you think of Jacob's reaction throughout this whole story? I think that's worthy of reflecting on a little bit more, because he seems to be unconcerned about his daughter, at least if we judge his silence to be communicative, that by not saying anything and by not doing anything, he seems to just want to sweep this whole incident under the rug. In fact, I suspect that he was duped by his own sons, that he thought, yeah, you know, this is all right. We can all be one happy, big Israelite, Hivite community here. Our two peoples becoming one, and we won't have to worry about any kind of punishment for the rape of my daughter.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't seem like he's apprised of the strategy here. I mean, he seems like he's surprised that this is how it went down.
Yeah, he was probably thinking to himself, yeah, that's a great idea that my sons had. This is good. Yeah, we can just take care of this whole situation, make it go away, and in the end, it would be better for all of us.
I mean, you would assume that only Simeon and Reuben knew, right?
Yeah, judging by their actions, yeah, they were the ones who devised the plan and then implemented the plan. And the other brothers were like, hey, look, there's a bunch of dead people. Let's go loot the city and take advantage of the situation. Now, I think this is instructive too, because in the last episode, we talked about Jacob's wrestling with the angel and then his reconciliation with his brother. And now in some ways it seemed as if Jacob was a changed man. I mean, the one incident in particular, he had held back. He'd put a buffer between himself and Esau. He'd used a human shield of all his wives and sons and servants and flocks and herds. And he was going to be the last guy to meet Esau. But then after his encounter with God and the name change, he actually walks ahead or limps ahead of everyone else. And he puts himself as the buffer between Esau and the rest of his family. So he actually acts self-sacrificially after his encounter with the angel. And then he's reconciled with his brother. And so it seems as if Jacob has turned over a new leaf. He's done the right thing. He's acted selflessly. And you get a whole new perspective on Jacob. And then you get to this story, and he's right back to being the same old Jacob. It's as if he's simultaneously a saint and a sinner. You know, it's as if he's just like one of us. Yeah. You know, we have these times where it seems like we're back on track and we're doing the right thing. And then we turn right around and we act selfishly. We act even despicably as sinners do. So we Jacob, we do what he does. We act out of self-interest rather than the interest of others. So we do this back and forth, this yo-yo of the Christian life, where one day we seem to be on track, the next day we're completely off the rails again. It's a good reminder that when you read these Old Testament stories, you're not reading them as prescriptive. Be like Jacob. No, don't be like Jacob. Please don't be like Jacob. Don't be like his sons. Don't be like the patriarchs in general. These stories are not some kind of example for us by how we are to live. Instead, they are exemplary of the grace of God despite the way that we live. Because the same grace that covered Jacob with all of his warts and blemishes and self-serving deeds, that same grace covers us with all of our warts and blemishes and our self-serving deeds. That's a message that you hear trumpeted through all these stories. And it's so obvious and yet so often missed in sermons and in Bible studies, that what we have here in all these stories is a story of the God who loves us and saves us despite every effort that we make to live a life unworthy of that love and that grace, just like Jacob did.
Yeah, I think that you learned in this story too that like we really suck at justice.
Big time.
Like, we don't know what we're doing.
We don't know what we're doing. Yeah. There's reason that God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, because you're going to totally screw it up if you decide that you're going to get vengeance.
Yeah, it's a bad...
You're two different extremes.
Yeah.
Jacob does nothing. His sons go and they take it out on an entire city.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, Brandon. Yeah, you have two extremes here. Do nothing or do way too much.
Yeah.
That's usually what happens when we deal with justice.
Yeah. What do you know? Nobody gets it right. Shocking.
Yeah, shocking. Interesting that God's name is not mentioned once in this whole chapter. It's as if he steps back and watches and just shakes his head like, oh my goodness, there they go again. Nobody gets it right. Not a single person.
That is a hot mess right there. But still interesting that's Israel, and
that's Israel. Yeah, that's the Old Testament church. That's the same church that we're a part of. It's just one great continuum from Old to New Testament. So what you see happening here, with maybe not the explicit deeds, but certainly the motivations and the manifestations of hate and anger and injustice and lust and everything else, they still take place today. Which is why the church claims a righteousness not her own, but the righteousness of Christ, because she is clothed with his goodness and with his mercy and with his holiness, not with her own, because she has none of her own.
Amen. Well, guys, that's it. We are out of time. So, hey, if you enjoy this program or anything else that we do at Christ Old Fast, you can go over to ChristOldFast.org and go to the support page or the giving page, and you could support us, and that would help us keep doing what we're doing. Thank you so much to those who have done that. We've got some conference stuff to announce, some more details of. Probably next week we're going to have like lots and lots of details on that stuff. So we're coming to New York, we're coming to Dallas. It's going to be amazing. So we'll flesh that out a little bit for you guys next week. So see you then.